Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Federalism and Separation of Powers Practice Group, was recorded on Friday, June 7th, 2013, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group telephone conference call on Gerald Walpin's book, The Supreme Court versus the Constitution. My name is Christian Corrigan, and I am Director of Publications here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are of those of the expert on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today, we welcome Mr. Gerald Walpin, who is a former Inspector General of the Corporation for National and Community Service, a former Chief of Prosecutions for the U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of New York, and the author of the subject of today's call, the book, The Supreme Court versus the Constitution. Our other expert is Professor Lillian Bevere, who is the David and Mary Harrison Distinguished Professor of Law Emeritus at the University of Virginia School of Law. More complete bios for our speakers were provided to you in notice of the call, so I will stop there and preserve more time for their presentations, followed by your questions. Mr. Walpin, the floor is yours.
Well, thank you very much, Christian, and I thank Professor Bevere for joining me on this call and all of you who are on the call. I think I should begin by telling you why I wrote this book. And the answer is very simply, because I, like I'm sure all of you on this call, love this country. And my book spotlights the unique gift that our founding fathers gave to us, which was a written constitution that was intended to guarantee that this country would forever be governed by the rule of law, not the rule of men, or today, the rule of men or women. Now, governed by the rule of law is not an empty phrase that simply sounds good. We know, in comparison to the United States, world history has been full of autocrats and tyrants who ruled on the basis of their own bias, prejudice, and self-interest. Our founding fathers gave us the written Constitution and the checks and balances it created, which were intended to prevent an autocrat or tyrant or anyone ruling on one's own bias and prejudice. And while not perfect, the checks and balances have worked pretty well, with Congress checking the president checking the Congress, the courts checking both the president and Congress, and the people, through elections, also check Congress and the president, as all of them are subject to election rejection. But there is nothing similar with regard to the third branch of government, the courts, and especially the Supreme Court, that, as my book details, can have a very substantial impact on all Americans' rights, security, and values, and yet is not subject to any check or balancing by the other branches of government, nor subject to being ousted by the people in an election. Yet our country's founders intended that the rule of law, not the rule of men, would govern Supreme Court justices as well as the President and Congress. I think we can agree what the rule of law means as applied to justices. It means that they should not decide cases based on their personal views because they happen to then be justices at the time, but on what is in the Constitution and what our Constitution's authors intended by the words they used in the Constitution. Thus, justices were intended to uphold laws enacted by legislatures that do not violate the Constitution, whether or not the individual justices approve those laws. And likewise, they were supposed to declare unconstitutional those laws that violate the Constitution, no matter that they personally like the law. Our founding fathers expressly stated what they believed the rule of law meant to our judges. I have in my book many different quotes, but let me just quote one here. Alexander Hamilton wrote in the Federalist Papers, recognized by all as the Bible of the meaning and intent of the Constitution, he wrote that judges were not to, and I quote, substitute their own pleasure to the constitutional intentions. And to avoid an arbitrary discretion in the courts, it is indispensable that they should be bound down by strict rules and precedents. Unfortunately, that has not happened. I start with examining one Supreme Court decision on which I would be surprised if anyone on this call, in fact, anyone that has any modern view of America, would be surprised, would disagree with me that it was incorrectly decided because it represented activist judges substituting their personal views for what the Constitution mandated. We all know that in 1868, the 14th Amendment was added to the Constitution. It prohibited all states from, and I quote, enforcing any law which shall deny to any person the equal protection of the laws, unquote. Pretty simple, clear words. And yet, despite these clear words, Louisiana arrested and convicted Homer Plessy, who happened to be 7/8 white and 1/8 black, for violating the state law that denied blacks the right to ride in railway coaches reserved for whites. When his conviction was reviewed by the Supreme Court, the 7-justice majority admitted that, and I quote, "The object of the amendment was undoubtedly to enforce the absolute equality of the two races before the law," unquote. Yet they upheld the conviction. How did that happen? Very simply, these justices substituted their personal bias of keeping blacks separate from whites for what the Constitution's words and intent required. Now, some would cast aside this sorry example as different from other examples where they agree with the bias that caused justices to depart from the Constitution. My book shows that either the Constitution controls or there is no control over justices who simply mandate their personal views. My book goes into various areas in which I show that a scant majority, often only 5 of justices, have substituted their personal views for what our founding fathers intended, and often doing a 180-degree turnaround from prior decisions of the court, although, of course, as we know, the Constitution remained unchanged. Those areas which I discuss in my book, and there were others I could have discussed, but I had to stop someplace, involve the Miranda decision, involve the law on search and seizure, involve the area of pornography and child pornography, violent video games, the death penalty, the country's relationship to God, abortion, prison terms, the court's wholesale release of state prisoners, the issue of profanity on the airways, animal torture, and the court even deciding how congressional money, meaning your taxpayer money, is to be appropriated. One would have thought the latter was fixed in the Constitution as being the responsibility of Congress. So, having said all that and introduced my book, I await Professor Brevere's comments and then any comments and questions from everybody on the phone. Thank you.
Shall I go now? I guess it's my turn, and I'm delighted to do this. I think that Jerry's book is a very interesting and important contribution because, for one thing, I think it's incredibly optimistic. It's optimistic in particular in that it seems to anticipate that lay people who are not lawyers are genuinely interested in the Constitution and in what the court is doing with respect to the Constitution, whether the court's string of decisions really has been faithful to the Constitution or not. And I think the way he ties the court's obligation to the Constitution, to to the basic founding theory of the country, is very useful in making the point that whatever name you call it, a theory, something like originalism, has and the original tethers and structure, if you will, of the government are terribly important to maintaining the liberty and the democracy that the founders put in place. Having said that, I have a couple of sort of questions for Jerry and a couple of points to make. One of them has to do with, because mostly my work has been in the First Amendment, so I'm more familiar with a lot of the First Amendment cases that he cites, and the ones that have troubled me as well, the nude pictures on drive-in movie screens, and child pornography, and virtual child pornography, and the crush videos, and the violent video games, and the First Amendment box that the court has gotten itself in, which has seemingly left the court without the ability to tell speech that really has some constitutional value from speech that doesn't have constitutional value. And the court just says, well, all speech is basically equal, and anything that regulates speech has got to run the same gamut of strict scrutiny. It seems to me that the court just got way off the mark in sort of getting away from the notion that the principal reason for protecting speech in the Constitution is to protect democracy and to protect speech about government. And the court has, in fact, in an ironic way, it certainly went through a period, it seems to be changing now, but it certainly went through a period of protecting political speech less firmly than it was protecting things like nude dancing and virtual child pornography and crush videos and violent video games. And that seems to me to have been a complete inversion of why we would want to have the First Amendment, why we would disable a legislature from being able to regulate speech. I can understand easily why we want to disable the legislature from regulating political speech about candidates, about policy, and so forth. It's hard for me to understand why we would want to disable a legislature from regulating virtual child pornography or crush videos or violent video games. But the court's doctrine as it now stands seems to have gotten them into that box, and I think it's crazy, and I think Jerry does quite a good job of describing that. The only thing that he doesn't do is to elaborate on his views about recent campaign finance reform cases. And I know that's a quagmire of an area, just because the doctrine has become so so intricate and so so hard to follow. But still, I'd love to have him answer a question that I have about where he would stand on that. But I have another just point to make, and this is about the abortion decision, and I think Jerry does a wonderful job of giving the history of that, the history of legislation regarding abortion and so forth. And he's all throughout the book, he's talking about departures from the constitutional structure and departures that represent the court grabbing power to decide things for itself and for the nation that the court has no business deciding. And I would recommend to anyone who's interested in this field, in addition to recommending Jerry's book, my colleague John Jeffries wrote a biography of Justice Lewis Powell. And I try to have as many students as I can read this, and I try to have as many lawyers as I can read this, along with Jerry's book, of course. But in this biography of Justice Powell, there's a fabulous chapter about what the court thought it was doing when it legalized abortion, and what theory the court had, what prompted the court to make the abortion ruling and what they thought the consequences were going to be. For Justice Powell's reasoning, it had to do with the fact that his father-in-law was an obstetrician and he believed in abortion. It had to do with the fact that he had a clerk in his law office who'd had a girlfriend who'd had a back alley abortion, and it had to do with the fact that his daughter was very pro-abortion. So those were the forces that persuaded Justice Powell that abortion should be legalized for the entire country. But it's also true and interesting to me that what the court thought when they did the abortion decision was that the country was ready for it, and that this, instead of creating the kind of horrible political turmoil that has been created by this decision, the court thought it was just and that everybody would be content with the decision, and then we could just move on with governing other things after we'd gotten the abortion thing settled. Well, as everybody knows, that's not what happened. Probably the abortion decision has been called by some the best thing that happened to the Republican Party in the 20th century. So because it energized the right to life movement and got them engaged in politics. So I just think that Jerry's discussion of the abortion case is right on the money, and I'm just adding that other piece of his analysis for whatever interest it might be for people. So I'm going to throw this back to Jerry now and see what he thinks about campaign finance regulation.
Well, first of all, I appreciate very much your comments, Lillian. Coming from you as particularly such an expert in the field, I appreciate them. I'm going to take the one on your comment on abortion first. I think it was rather interesting and may also be a crystal ball gazing as to her vote on another issue that I think has a similar problem as abortion, and that is same-sex marriage. Justice Ginsburg was quoted someplace, as I've forgotten where, as saying that she thought the Roe v. Wade decision should have been left to the state legislatures and allowed the state legislators, who have always been considered by the Supreme Court until most recently as the best measure of public view on any issue. And I think that is really the fact. I enjoyed Lillian's comment about Roe v. Wade may have been the best thing for the Republican Party, because it certainly has steeled the backbone of many conservatives as to the problem with liberal elitists substituting their own personal views, as exemplified by Professor Bevere's relating the motivation that has been suggested for Justice Powell's vote on Roe v. Wade. It's a sad day when a justice decides an issue of such importance to the country, of such importance that today a majority of the people polled don't believe that abortion should be legalized, that a justice decides it on the basis of his law clerk or secretaries or relatives' experience in the area. And that is basically the background of the book that I have attempted to write, to show that in areas that are of everyday involvement of the average American Joe or Jane, the Supreme Court has changed the values, the means of security of people that have a peaceful existence in their own town, in their own streets, in their own house, without any change in the Constitution, merely to reflect the elitist views of those who happen to be on the Supreme Court. I mean, one of the, and I'll get to campaign finance in a minute if I may, one of the most amazing and I think ignored historical facts, is a number of comments made by our founding fathers and by the Supreme Court itself for many years after the creation of the Constitution, that they considered the protection and enhancement of morality as one purpose our Constitution fixed for our country and government. You don't hear that today. You hear people saying that morality, it can't be defined. Well, I think most people know morality when they see it, and they know immorality when they see it. One might say that nobody could define with any serious definition the instruction to a jury that you have to decide conviction or guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. Sure, words are used, but obviously those words that are given to a jury itself require the person making that evaluation to look at it and decide, is there reasonable doubt or is there not? And I think the same thing is true about morality, although too many people today ignore morality as a purpose of government. And Professor Bevere's statement that the First Amendment was purpose to protect democracy, I think that's so true. And again, our founding fathers said that without morality, the values on which this country was formed and has to live would not stand. Now, how the Supreme Court, which for many years made clear the test of whether the First Amendment precludes any prohibition of a writing or a film, is does the writing or film provide a basic, in substance, an addition to the thoughts and ideas and values that are important to people in evaluating their future. How they can say that a pornographic movie, as some of them are, could possibly add serious social value to our country is beyond me. They've lost sight of the purpose of the First Amendment, just as we all agree that the First Amendment freedom of the speech doesn't allow you total freedom to speak what you want where you are. The example of yelling fire in a movie theater is the clearest example. So too, the First Amendment right to do a film or a book doesn't allow you to say anything you want in that film or book. And that had been the rule until the mid and late 20th century. On your question on campaign speech and political speech, I didn't include that in the book. Maybe I should have, but I didn't, because I tried to include those things that directly affect all individuals in their personal life. Whether they're values that they're trying to teach their children, the security that they expect the government to provide them on the streets and in their homes, and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I didn't include the First Amendment on political speech. But having you've asked me, and I will state that I cannot understand how one can preclude an individual from speaking through his pocket, as we do when we contribute to a candidate. That is political speech. I find it totally inconsistent that the law and the court allow an individual who's a billionaire to spend as much as he wants on promoting a candidate, sure there's a limitation of what he can give to the candidate directly, but that is a difference in form, not in substance, and yet prevent other people who want to use their wealth to promote another person as a candidate. It just makes no sense. Freedom of speech means freedom to support a candidate, and I think the original limitation on how much you could give to a candidate is wrong. I think it is a limitation on freedom of speech.
Yeah. Jerry, I have another question for you, and this is a little bit off topic of the main part of your book, but I was completely fascinated by your story of being an inspector general and of the way in which you were fired from that job. And I wonder if you could share some of your thoughts about how that experience suggested some reason to be concerned, uneasy, about the extent to which we have retained, either in this administration or in other administrations, our fidelity to the rule of law. I was stunned by what happened at the time it happened, and very surprised that it didn't get a whole lot of press. But of course, that was at the time when the press was in the throes of its complete and total infatuation with the president, as I recall. So they weren't going to call him on it. But that was outrageous behavior on the part of the administration. Maybe you could just tell us a little bit about what happened.
I appreciate that question. Frankly, I consider it a badge of honor that I got fired because of what happened. I'll just give a quick statement about it. But I will then go on to, because I think you are right on the impact of my firing, and frankly, most were unaware of. Mine got reasonable publicity, not in the in the liberal press, but in the mainstream conservative press, like the Wall Street Journal.
Right.
But there were four other, I believe, inspector generals that were fired after I was fired.
Right.
By the same administration.
And those positions still haven't been filled, I understand.
Some of them haven't been.
Yeah,
that's
okay.
Correct. That's right. But I was fired solely because when I took on the position, I had a staff of very able civil servants, totally non-political. They were auditors and investigators, and they would go out and they would find out facts either based upon a whistleblower's information that was given us or upon looking at and auditing some records of those individuals and entities who received lots of taxpayers' money. And they would come to me with their report of investigation, and I would evaluate it, and if it appeared to be supportable and supported, I would support them to the hilt. Well, they came to me with, at one point, with a report on Johnson, who I didn't know was a Kevin Johnson, had been a basketball player. I did not know that he was a very close friend and supporter of President Obama. So I just agreed with them, supported them, and said we will go ahead with the proceeding against Johnson.
What had he done, Jerry?
He had essentially used for his own personal purposes close to $1 million of a grant given by AmeriCorps to Kevin Johnson for a student school that he was running.
Okay.
But he didn't use it for the school. He used it for himself. Okay. And the facts were clear, and we proceeded. Well, as we proceeded, suddenly I received pressures. You ought to drop this. It's not worth it. And I refused to bend. I told my staff about it, and they were shocked. And they, of course, appreciated the fact that I was supporting them. And then suddenly, on a Wednesday afternoon, when I was known to be out of town for a conference, I get a phone call in the car saying, "You're fired. You can resign or be fired." And I, of course, refused to resign because I wouldn't give them a stamp of approval. If they wanted to fire me, let them do it. And so that is what happened to me. The problem is it happened to some other IGs as well,
mm-hmm.
and it has caused a great worry, understandably perhaps, in the ranks of inspectors general. If they don't use a line very well, who knows what will happen to them. And it worries me because I see, for example, the testimony of the IG of the IRS today, and cannot understand how, as he said, that he would investigate what went on with the looking at conservative groups, microscopic examination of conservative groups, talk to the people in the Cincinnati field who had done this, and not ask them, who had instructed you to do this? Who did you consult with? I mean, I find that just incredible, but I find that probably a result of somebody who is an inspector general not wanting to lose his job.
Right, right. So I think it's very disturbing, and although it is sort of off point of your book, the central point, it's just another example of the sort of the loosening of the bounds of the rule of law, which really is something that I think protects all of us from not only from the government but from one another. You have clear rules; everybody abides by the same rules, and things are much more fair all around, and they're much more reliable, and you don't have to be nervous about being fired for doing your job, for example.
Mm-hmm. You say that very well, Lillian.
There's another thing that I'd love to have your thoughts about, and that has to do with the theme I got from your book, in addition to the departure by the modern Supreme Court from the constitutional principles of the founding fathers. One of the themes that you hammer early and often, and I believe rightly so, is that so much of what the court has done in these decisions has been to make all the source of all power and all standards for government behavior national. And they've just, I think of this even in terms of the 14th Amendment decisions where, and the First Amendment, every decision that they make applies not just to the little town in Ohio where the problem arose, but to every town, village, city, state, county in the country. And all of a sudden, every school district is being ruled for First Amendment purposes by the Supreme Court of the United States. That part, that sort of federalism piece, if you will, of the court's behavior, I think bears real emphasis.
I tried to emphasize that, and you strike a very important chord there, because we have to remember that when a local legislature or a state legislature or even the Congress decides on what the law should be in an area that they have jurisdiction to decide, the people can always change that. And if, for example, a state were to say by the legislature that abortion should be allowed, the people, by their voting in and voting out legislators, can change that. It's not there in cement. Whereas when the Supreme Court decides something, it decides it not only for each individual entity, as for example on pornography, suddenly it is no longer the local community standard, which was the rule under the first and for a long time Supreme Court decisions on pornography. What is pornography? It becomes a nationally fixed standard that cannot be replaced by the voters because the Supreme Court says what the supposedly says what the Constitution required,
yeah.
And therefore it's fixed in stone.
Do you think that one of the things? Well, I want to talk about pornography and the internet in particular, because. I mean, I think I agree with you for the most part in terms of your analysis, but it strikes me that that genie has gotten so far out of the bottle that there's not, that as a practical matter, that fight is over, and it's not a fight anymore. It simply is what it is. It's a huge business. I think it's in the billions of dollars.
Yes, and it has vast impact on crime in our country. Mm-hmm. I mean, I quote in the book a horrible story about an individual defendant and what he did in a horrible, horrible rape, which where he duplicated, his lawyer said, 24 times, and the lawyer gives us the reason because... this is what he would do after seeing rape pornography.
Right.
The impact on our society is great. And I'm not willing to give up, though, that good justices could be turned around to what had been the Supreme Court's original meaning, which was that the First Amendment protects only ideas that have a social value as a step to truth, that are not outweighed by the social interest in order and morality. That was a Supreme Court, I quote from, even from 1942. That's not that far away.
Right. No, I agree with that. The Supreme Court could, but I just don't think that the law enforcement will is there.
Well,
a colleague of mine told me a very interesting story about a prosecutor in Salt Lake City, Utah, and he was trying to prosecute a local purveyor of pornography. And at the time he was trying to prosecute it, he was bound by community standards. So he was sitting in his office one day, and he looked across the street, and there was a Marriott hotel. Well, Marriott is not known for its liberal social views or its liberal policy with respect to sex or alcohol or any other sort of vice activities. But so what the prosecutor did, because he wanted to demonstrate that this kind of pornography was not acceptable in the community, he went and rented a room at the hotel and at the Marriott and checked out what was on offer on the adult channels, and he was more horrified to discover that what the purveyor of pornography was doing in his local shop was no different from the pornography that was available on Marriott's local channel.
That's so sad.
It's sad that I think it. I agree with you, but it's also it just strikes me as, you know, I feel a sense of futility about that one.
I just refuse to give up. But
good for you.
Lillian, should we let people who are on the line ask or make comments?
Sure, certainly. If there are people that want to, I'd be delighted.
Christian?
Fantastic. This is Christian Corrigan. So I think we'll go now and open up the lines for your questions. For our audience, in a moment, you'll hear a prompt that will say the floor mode is on. After that, to request the floor, enter star and then the pound key. Again, that's star and then the pound key.
This is David Applegate in Chicago. First of all, I would like to salute Jerry Walpin, with whom I used to serve on the same Intellectual Property Executive Committee, for his exemplary public service to this country under some rather difficult circumstances, which he's previously described in this call.
You're very kind. Thank you.
You're welcome. Second, I would like to recount a disturbing public statement that well-known Seventh Circuit Judge Richard Posner made in response to a question I posed several years ago at a bankruptcy law seminar here in Chicago in the wake of the General Motors bankruptcy, in which Judge Posner opined that, in his opinion, the rule of law meant nothing more than that judges would not decide a case in favor of General Motors, for example, because they happened to own General Motors stock. Other than that, he opined a federal judge could do pretty much whatever he wanted. And in this particular case, he opined that this was a national emergency and it was the duty of the judiciary to stand behind the executive branch and give the president what he wanted. But putting aside the obvious separation of powers issues, my question for either or both of the panelists is, if that is the opinion of a high-ranking member of the judiciary who sits one step below the United States Supreme Court, how do we turn this around as concerned citizens who are interested not only in public policy, but in the rule of law, and in particular, the primacy of laws set forth in the Constitution?
Well, it's a very good question, but I'll trump your example. Justice Brennan was known to ask a new law clerk when he came on board what the law clerk thought was the most important factor in deciding cases that involve the Constitution and the interpretation of the Constitution. And most law clerks obviously immediately said, well, the words of the Constitution. Of course, he would say that's not true. And the law clerks would never get the answer. And so Brennan said, I will tell you the answer. And he held up his hand with the five fingers outstanding. And he said, that what decides what the Constitution means, getting five justices to agree with you. To agree. Now, that's exactly the same. That there's no, it's not the question of what the Constitution says. Now, Posner is a very smart guy. I like him a lot of times, but to the extent that he said that, I think it ignores the rule of law and the reason that our founders had a written Constitution rather than just writing out a one-sentence theory that we will try to be fair and rely on five justices to have the best decision-making as to what is fair. And the way we, and to answer your question as far as I'm concerned, is every single person who is nominated to be a justice should be asked what he or she thinks about the Brennan example and the Posner example. And if they say they agree with Brennan or Posner on this, they should be confirmed.
But, of course, they're not going to say that, Jerry. That's part of the
difficulty.
I know. Even Sotomayor.
Yes. You are right, and but at least it can be it can be spotlighted in the hope that this may sink in.
That's right. Well, can I pitch in just a little bit here and talk a little bit about one of the roots of the problem is, I fear, in law schools today, and I think it's one of the reasons that the Federalist Society was begun, and one of the reasons it's flourished is because the law schools are, I don't even know how to put it, the professors tend to be very much on the Brennan and Posner side of what the rule of law means. And their notion is they bought the sort of legal realist, very cynical look at law, hook, line, and sinker. So they just don't believe that it is that anybody is going to be faithful to anything other than their own personal, philosophical, or political views. And because that's true, they then feel that it's appropriate for judges and justices to do what they personally like. And so, I mean, it's gotten so far that you, if you read the New York Times editorial on the day on the first Monday of October, you will read something that has a prescription for all the important cases that the court should decide and how they should decide them, and that has nothing to do whatsoever with either the rules or the precedents or what the Constitution says. It's a pure political program. So if law schools could begin to change, and I think that's really what the Federalist Society is most focused on, could begin to have more of a voice for rule of law values and the importance to the society of the rule of law, I think that is crucially important. So.
Very true.
This is Christian Corrigan again. I think we have at least one more question on the line. We've got about 9 minutes left in our call, so we'll try to get through. If you'd like to ask a question, again, press star and the pound key, and we should be able to get in at least one more question after this one.
Yes, thank you for doing the teleform. My name is Diana Simpson. I'm out in Arizona. My question for you is about the opposite of judicial activism, but judicial deference. And do you identify a point at which judicial deference to the other branches amounts to abdication of a judge's oath to the Constitution? And if so, where is that point?
Well, I will answer that this way. If the other branch has clearly violated the terms and conditions of the Constitution and or clearly set precedent by the Supreme Court, then at that point they should be put down. I think the best example is the Plessy case. No one today would seriously disagree that the Louisiana legislature went beyond its authority when it ignored the 14th Amendment and had that law in the books and enforced it. We can talk about other similar situations. I think, for example, here I'm going to crystal ball gaze and go into an area that I'm very interested in, although it's not in my book, and that Professor Brevere really raised implicitly, the issue of diversity and affirmative action. The problem with the Texas case that is before the Supreme Court is that it so clearly was contrary to the constitutional principles put down even in the Grutter case by the Supreme Court when it first allowed affirmative action, clearly. Certainly the Supreme Court in the University of Texas case that is before it will be decided either next Monday or the following Monday, should say that this method of a state trying to prefer one race over another is contrary to the Constitution. And if I can just add one thing to what Lillian said, the greatest proof that diversity is not really the desire of these affirmative action statutes and rules is that it does not in any way impact on the one diversity area that is most important to college students, the diversity of ideas. The large drop in 50 years of percentage of conservatives on faculty as against the increase, the tremendous increase of liberals and Democrat voting as against Republican voting faculty members, shows you can't have the real diversity of ideas, which is the most important, because most faculty self-pick those who agree with them.
Yeah, I think that I would just add one thing, and that is I think your question is really a good one in the sense, in particular, that it suggests that we go wrong when we say, quote, activism is bad and deference is good as principles of judicial decision making. I think that's not correct. I think what you need to do is have principle that tells you what the right decision is. And sometimes you are going to seem to be active because you will be in a position that because what the Constitution requires you to do is to do something that strikes down legislation passed either by Congress or by a state legislature. So that's not active in a bad way. That's doing your duty. And sometimes deference is a function of the fact that the task that you are now being asked to oversee, the task that you're being asked to question and find unconstitutional on the part of another branch of government, has been assigned to that other branch of government by the Constitution. So if you defer to that other branch of government, you're doing it not because deference is a principle, but because the Constitution structure insists that you do that. That's you're being faithful to the Constitution structure.
If I may just add, in my book I quote Justice Holmes, who I think epitomized the justice who ignores his own personal views in favor of what his constitutional responsibilities require him to how to vote. He expressly noted in one case that he was voting for the position of the appellant, even though he personally viewed appellant's position as being, and I quote, a creed which I believe to be the creed of ignorance and immaturity, unquote. Well, it's up to the legislature, not the justice, to decide what is to be the creed to be followed, as long as it is not inconsistent with the Constitution.
Well, it looks like we have just a few minutes left on the call, and we do have one more question on the line. I think we should be able to squeeze it in. So please make your question short, and hopefully we can get it answered within the last few minutes.
Hi, this is Dave Tryon in Cleveland. So I wasn't able to attend quite everything that was spoken, but I had a question about the decision, the Obamacare decision, what Justice Roberts' opinion was, and there was some discussion earlier about that the New York Times attempts to influence the justices, and there's a belief out there by some anyways that Justice Roberts was in fact influenced by opinions of popular media. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, unfortunately, I'm not a psychiatrist, maybe no psychiatrist would have the ability to look into Justice Roberts' mind. I find it very difficult to understand how he could say that the purpose of the statute was a tax statute, to impose a tax, when all of the legislative history and statements on it were that it was not a tax. He decided it. There was a wonderful CBS court reporter who has said that she learned that he changed his mind at the last minute, had been in favor of holding it, the statute, unconstitutional. If all those statements are correct, and he just bowed to media pressure that he thought would infect the reputation of his court, I think it's wrong.
I would suggest that you have to read the opinion, and when you read his opinion, especially the tax part, the part that upholds the individual mandate, it's not a very persuasive opinion, and it comes sort of out of left field. So, I mean, part of the reason for wondering about what his motivation was, at least for my own part, is that he's a pretty careful and pretty smart guy, and he usually makes some kind of sense. In this opinion, it's just hard for me to find the sense, just the logic in what it is that he was doing. And I think the same is true in the part of it where he voted to permit the state's requirement that they join Medicaid, that was unconstitutional. That's a very strange opinion for another reason, and that is that he basically rewrites the statute. So that's unusual behavior for a conservative, a principled judge, and I thought it was very difficult to explain.
So this is Christian Corrigan. We are out of time. So on behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank both of our experts today. Thank you also to our audience for taking the time out of your day as well to tune in. We always welcome your feedback by email to info@fedsoc.org. And once again, don't forget to join us Tuesday, June 11th for our first annual Executive Branch Review Conference and visit our new blog, executivebranchproject.com. And we are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.